Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
Be evasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. And there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
All right. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Hey, what y'all want? I was just sitting here. I didn't know. Huh? Good morning. It is the 30th of July. We're almost into August now. Whoa. On 2020, it's Thursday, 30th of July. Good morning to everybody. Hope everybody's well. And come up on Saturday, even though it's about 8 days early, 6 days early, something like that. Saturday is Lunasa, and Lunasa is the start of fall. It's the celebration of the start of fall. This is harvest season, and that's what fall is all about. And we get up to the midpoint of fall with the equinox. And we get into winter. And you get to Halloween, that's about when winter starts. Think about it. It all adds up. Well, okay. Now, you listen to Revolution Radio. And we are found at revolution.radio. Makes sense. And we're found at freedomslips.com. Both roads lead to the same destination, which is the main site wherein you find the players and the chat room and all the good information you need to know. We're entirely user supported. I ask everybody to give like $5 in a month's time. That should be enough to get us down the road if everybody who listens gives. You know, and if you listen to like one show a week, that's 4 shows a month. That's $1.25 a show. If you listen to a lot more of that, the more you listen, the less it's going to cost you. Or you could become a patron at Patreon and arrange to give $4, $5, whatever dollars a month, or as much as you like, of course. And that will help us. And not only that, I also need to add that we have the archives for free through September, I believe it is. And all you have to do is go to revolutionradioarchives.com. When you get there, you'll be asked for a password, and the password, let me start with the username. The username is RevRadio, R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O, RevRadio, and the password is ROCKS, R-O-C-K-S, exclamation point. You got to put that exclamation point. That will bring you to as many of the archives as we have presently uploaded, and we're throwing more up all the time. It's somewhat time-consuming, but, or I should say, and we just started, so it'll take a while before we get up to a full complement of what can be heard. Now, not every show that ever was on this station can be heard, because Nighthawk was typically in the practice of, you know, after they got 2 years old, he'd throw them out. So some of them we just can't put our fingers on. But whatever we can get our hands on, we will throw up. And therefore, it will be available to you as archives. After September, we're going to make some offerings. It will no longer be free. This is a way of paying you back for having to wait as long as you did. to make up for it, because it was an inconvenience, especially, well, if you'd paid for them, you were getting them, but the thing is, you weren't getting anything new. So, you know, right after this show, if I go to the archives, I can download this show and listen to it. And there's two ways you can do it. You can download it, or you can just listen to a player. So that has expanded, too, the potentials. Well, I mess with my microphone here. Okay, yeah, I changed the studio around. I widened the studio by about 2.5 feet yesterday. Very nice. Now I got the monitors near 8 feet apart, between 7 and 8 feet apart, and that's much better. I have more room. Place needs cleaning up anyway, but or straightening up, I should say. It's not that dirty. It's just very cluttered. But actually, if you're recording, the more cluttered your recording space, the better it is for the sound, especially in the low register, the bass notes, because bass notes have very long waves. The waves can start lengthening out to 6, 8, 10, 20 feet, depending upon the note. And all sorts of things can militate towards you not hearing what you need to hear properly. And so if you keep the place all cluttered up, that tends to break it up in ways that is beneficial to you. Ways that are. Pardon my grammar. And so, yeah, I been working on something. There's no bass. It's just guitar and drums. Let's see. And because I'm going to listen to this as soon as it's over. I was not happy with the way the music was translating over the station as I listened to it. And I can tell because I've heard pretty good translations from other hosts, depending upon what they're playing. I don't know. I think maybe it was because I had something engaged in Skype I shouldn't have. But here, let's give this a try just for fun. We'll be right back. Well, I'll see you on the replay. It should be, I mean, even though it's gained out to all sorts of awful degrees, it should be coming over dead crystal clear. And that's what I'm not hearing. And I don't know if it's because my mic is on and that's causing artifacts. And I can't turn the mic off. If I do, then you won't hear one side. It cuts off one side of the stereo field. Skype is weird to work with. And not only that, it's 8-bit. And it ought to be at least 16-bit. All CDs are 16-bit. And this is recorded at, 64-bit. Today's 64-bit computers are really far. They're really going far in their recording ability. So, there's that. It's far from a finished product. A lot more got to do with it. But it was mostly for an experiment. So when I play it back for myself after the show, I'll see what I think about the way the sound translated. And I will get to the bottom of this. I don't believe it's because it's not an MP3 yet. And so it's full CD cluster density. But I don't believe that's what it is or what it is. So we'll see. Yeah, it's the warbliness, Troy Boy. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's what disturbs me. And again, it could be artifacts induced by the microphone being right here because I'm not using earphones. I am using my studio monitors. That could be part of the problem. I will get to the bottom of it. okay, but like I say, it's not finished. Anyway, what is going on upstairs? Where are we? Well, yesterday we had a nice sun trine moon. That's always good. Now the moon is up at pushing 19 degrees of Sagittarius, while the sun is almost 8 degrees of Leo. And we will have a moon-Venus opposition later this afternoon, evening. That's nice. It's not that oppositions are bad. They're just conscious. If the planetary energies involved or get along with each other, then there shouldn't be any problem at all with that. Squares, oppositions, conjunctions tend to produce events. They're conscious aspects, whereas trines are in sextiles are more of a homeostasis. They indicate states of being. And we're coming out of a moon trine Mars. That's hard to beat. We're still in it. We just broke the 1 degree, but we'll be feeling that for the rest of the afternoon, I think. And I don't think there's a whole heck of a lot going on. Saturn and Jupiter are still both backing up in Capricorn. I had to get both of those babies out of Capricorn. Of course, Saturn had gotten into Aquarius before this COVID bullshit started, so can't say. Of course, it's not safe to ascribe causes to this, that, or the other thing. Everything's always all working at once. And because of that, you know, it gets dangerous to try and get too finger pointy about things. Oh, boy. Okay, so that's kind of what's going on up there. Now, what can I get into? I often look at SOTT, Signs of the Times. And I have a wonderful article here. It's entitled, Orcs March on Minas Tirith in Mostly Peaceful Protest. And this is from the Babylon Bee on Wednesday. And Dateline Minas Tirith. Orcs marched on Minas Tirith this morning in a mostly peaceful protest. The rioters marched for peace, justice, and love in a calm, peaceful, orderly gathering outside the city walls. The mostly peaceful protesters launched peaceful siege projectiles at the city and sent Nazguls to maul Gondorian soldiers in a demonstration of their love and tolerance. Everything is very calm, very peaceful here, said a reporter from the Gondor News Network. It's very tranquil. Just then, an Oliphant charged right at him and flattened him into Limbus bread. Gondor's government was criticized for police brutality when, after a long period of inaction, Rohan's armies finally charged in to break things up. We were just peacefully protesting. Gondor had no right to peacefully protest back, said one orc. Two of their agents were even having a contest to see how many of us they could kill, and they were killing the majestic, endangered Oliphants. I'm literally shaking right now. Yep, that's that article. What else do we have? It's about the size of it, isn't it? I was looking also at some of the high strangeness area with a couple of interesting articles in it. Exorcist claims possessed woman threw four men across the room and spoke demonic language. And this is by Sophie Jackson from the Daily Star. To wit, a practicing exorcist claims he once witnessed a terrifying case of demonic possession where a woman with a demon inside her threw four men across a room. Well, is she saying that they took her on one at a time? Or she managed to do it to all four at once? They're just delightfully unclear about these sorts of things. Anyway, to continue, Bishop Plato Angelakis, an ordained Orthodox Catholic priest with the Oblates of St. Teresa in Wisconsin, said it was his first ever exorcism and involved himself and a small group of other priests. The victim, a 60-year-old woman, was said to have not eaten or drank anything for a month, and so the priest visited her home to try and rid her of the evil presence. Talking on the Exorcist TV show podcast, Bishop Angelakis explained what he saw. For the most part, she showed extraordinary strength, three or four of us throwing us around the room. There were about four adults, he said, with amazing lack of detail, too. As well as this disturbing display of physical strength, Bishop Angelakis recalled that the woman showed other telltale signs of possession, too. He said, the whites of her eyes were all back. You try doing that. That's something you can't naturally do. Some language coming out. Strength is probably the number one thing for her. She had extraordinary strength. Fortunately, Bishop Angelakis said there was one thing in his favor while trying to get rid of this difficult demon. He said, for some reason, this particular entity could not leave the home. I don't know why. Once we got her out, there was nothing. So when she was out of the home, it was just fine. It took 2 days to liberate the woman from the demon, he added, but her family remained practicing Satanists. Oh dear, that certainly would help now, wouldn't it? Bishop Angelakis said that at this point in his career with the church, he had never encountered something like this before. To this day, it is one of the most intense exorcisms of a person I have ever encountered, he said. This comes after a Catholic archbishop claimed that victims of demonic possession can kill with just their teeth and have the strength of five men. He also said they have eyes as black as sharks, among other disturbing details. And a woman claimed she was possessed by a demon as a teenager after being haunted and harassed following her dabbling in Wicca magic with pals. The ex-witch said she would smell dead flesh and wake up covered in scratches. Well, I guess it's always good to know what you're getting into before you get into anything, but such as life. Yeah, strong demon, huh? Hello, boy Solomon. I hope everyone is good today. I see at the top of the list, I see Bruce. Then I see Fact or Theory, or as I am wont to go with it, Factor Theory. Sorry, Stephen. Troy Boy, Blasphemous Buddha, Chevy Cool, Mario, Mona Radler, Lady Horse, Monster 383, Saul Rosenberg, Maced 139, Festus B, me, not me, but me, Reg, Comet, Omega Logos, Wally, who else? I got to pull this up now. Jerbear, Dirt Engineer, Mr. Rowe, Stardust Man, Popsicle Toes, SJ, Sonali, Boy Solomon, Sorry Sunflower, Batsman, In the Kitchen, and finally myself, Pat Rabbit. And this is Not for Public Consumption with Pat Rabbit. So, we're hopping off to the races right about now. Now, let's see what else I can have a look at. Da-da-da-da. There is something that I get into time and again here. And he doth protest too loudly, they will say. I am just trying to spread some knowledge for those who might consider it such. This is from an article at occult-mysteries.org, my favorite website. And I've read from this article a number of times, and it's about Blavatsky. Elena Petrovna Blavatsky, one of the greatest people of modern times. And this part of it I will get into, and you will see why. What of the accusation? I'm starting with the article. What of the accusation that Blavatsky taught a form of Satanism? To occultists, and when this word is used in this site, it simply means that which is hidden and not easily available, because the word means to cover, to hide, to occult something. It does not mean darkness. It does not mean evil or any of the popular connotations associated with the word. To occultists, such a suggestion is simply laughable, but as it is such a common misconception, and not all our readers are occultists, we will try to answer it. And to be an occultist would mean someone who studies occult science, otherwise known as the ancient wisdom, which that would define myself, actually. To continue, the first thing we would say is that the church does not have a monopoly on the word Lucifer, nor its definition. The church's use of the word as a synonym for the devil is of very recent origin, which was adopted to strengthen its hold over the superstitious minds of its followers, which it did nothing to enlighten, as you can read in our article on How Peace Leads to War. Many readers may be surprised to learn that the word Lucifer occurs only once in the whole Bible, and then only as a synonym for light and goodness, not darkness and evil. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? And this is Isaiah 14:12, the only place in the entire tome where you will find the word mentioned. Lucifer is simply the Latin equivalent of a Hebrew word meaning bright star or shining one used by the translators of the Bible. Lucifer literally means light bringer, light bearer, bringer of dawn, shining one, or morning star. The word has no other meaning in Latin. And as an aside, in Greek, it will be phosphorus. Okay. Moreover, the bright morning star was the symbol and harbinger of the light and love of God among many ancient nations, including the Chinese, Indians, and Egyptians, who all associated it with the planet Venus. Were these nations devil worshippers too? Only the most fanatical and dogmatic of Christians would say so. It was not until the 6th century that Pope Gregory, 540 to 604 AD, first called attention to the verse from Isaiah and used it to equate Lucifer with Satan. It was Pope Gregory who's behind this. It's the church. Sorry. I'll get back to the article real quick or I'll go off the rails. In this way, he cunningly robbed the hated Gnostics of their light bringer, whose heresies threatened the dominance of the church, and at the same time added another stick with which to beat the faithful into submission by reinforcing the dogma of original sin, from which taint only he and his fellow priests could absolve them. But the identification of Lucifer with Satan did not take root in the popular mind until much later, when Milton adopted the word for the principal actor in his metaphysical drama, Paradise Lost, in 1667. Pardon me. Yet, as we have seen, Satan has nothing in common with the bright morning star worshipped by the Babylonians and ancient Hebrews other than the name Lucifer. Pardon me, I need to clear my throat. Excuse me, I didn't get the mic quite muted before. Okay. Despite this, the church's imposture was completely successful, and Lucifer has been associated with Satan ever since, except in the minds of those who, like Blavatsky, knew that to conflate the two is as inexcusable on historical grounds as it is on theological or moral grounds. Readers who, despite these facts, remain unconvinced that Lucifer is not Satan are advised to turn to Revelation chapter 22, verse 16, in which they will find, I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright and morning star. End quote. Had the compilers of the New Testament chosen to translate this verse into Latin, as they did with the verse from Isaiah, it would read, I, Jesus, am the root and offspring of David and Lucifer. Although Revelation was compiled in the first century, it was not included in the biblical canon until well after Lucifer had already been adopted as a synonym for Satan. So it is not surprising that the church favored its translation of bright and morning star over the contentious word Lucifer found in Isaiah. From this, it must be clear that those who persist in their assumption that Lucifer is the devil cannot appeal to the Bible in support of their misconception. You can read more about the esoteric meaning of the word Lucifer in our afterword to this article. And Lucifer is actually far less an entity than it is a principle. But I see it so much, and it makes me sad. And considering this station is about truth to the degree that we can bring it, I typically will say something, and I don't blame those who do say it, but it would still remain to be the fact that what they're doing is using the word according to a connotation and definition that was started by Pope Gregory of the Catholic Church. And it continued down through the centuries. It's just not true. hey, you know, it's what it is. It's just a word. But in one respect, it's almost like equating God with the devil. And most of us wouldn't do that. So, all right, enough of that. And that's from occult-mysteries.org, my favorite site. I might read more of this because it's very good, but I'll jump to something else in a second. There is a new article on their site. Be probably the last one they put in for July. But then August 1st is on Saturday, so another week or two, and they'll have another one. These guys have just gobs of articles. But this article is on fools and folly. Folie in French, F-O-L-I-E. In these tumultuous times of test and trial, when folly seems triumphant and wisdom lies scorned and discarded in the waste places of the world, we thought a few wise words about fools and foolishness might be appreciated by our old and new readers alike. It is said that a fool and his money are soon parted. Also, that fools rush in where angels fear to tread. But can we say the same thing about a fool and his thinking? Always provided a fool does think. This is a question only the wise can answer, and they remain silent. So how can one persuade a fool of his foolishness? None but a fool is always right in his beliefs, impatience, and opinions. And Schiller once said that the world belongs to the fool. Maybe he was right up to a point, but the fool is disillusioned in the end, if and when he comes to his senses. William Blake thought that if a fool persisted in his folly, he would become wise in the end. This seems an especially foolish remark from a man who wisely saw a whole world in a grain of sand. Very good of Blake to do that. On the other hand, is a wise man incapable of folly? La Rochefoucauld thought not, for he said that he who lives without folly is not as wise as he thinks. We agree, perhaps Blake meant that folly must give way to wisdom eventually, since life may make the greatest fool wise through bitter experience. Molière said that there is nothing quite so odious as a learned fool. So, as an aside, there is no ass like an educated ass. So true. Okay, back to the article. This has never been truer than today, when we are surrounded on all sides by learned fools masquerading as all manner of experts, telling us what we should and should not say, do, eat, drink, and think. Some fools are lucky, for no creature hurts so little as a fool. He doesn't have enough sense to know when he is hurt at the moment the wise man perceives his foolishness. A rogue might be considered a kind of roundabout fool, for he lacks the wisdom to be honest. And in this world of rogues, it may be very hard at times for some sorely tempted persons to remain fair and honest. But to appear foolish needs a lot of brains and wisdom. Fools often ape the defects of their betters. This is well worth knowing, for by seeing ourselves at our worst, when we behold the fool in all his glory, we may acquire more wisdom. But only if we were wise already. Otherwise, it is a waste of time to bother about fools. Sip time. You're right there. As we have taken fools for our theme, let satire be our anthem. For it is good to learn from anybody, even a complete fool. But by foolishness, we do not mean levity, for that is quite another disease, though equally foolish in some ways, except when humor is used to lighten a difficult situation. Then levity becomes a form of wisdom, and it may be used as a mask behind which the wise man or woman conceals themselves from the fools of this world. In such cases, it is better to be a witty fool than a foolish wit. It is also wise at times to mix a little folly with one's wisdom, to lighten the burden and bring relief to the mind which might otherwise become semi-paralyzed by one's erudition. There should ever be a just modicum of balance between foolishness and wisdom. For he who believes that he can exist without folly is not so wise as he thinks he is. Of course, there are degrees of foolishness, for a person may be as much a fool from the want of sensibility as the want of sense. Most people do not stop to think what a little foolery can do in governing the affairs of the world. One has only to read the news with a thinking mind to learn the truth of this idea. This brings us full circle. Do fools think? And is a young fool any different to an old fool, like the writer, perchance? Our answer is the same as Agatha Christie's, who wrote that all young men think that old men are fools, but all old men know that young men are. Byron, who was chased out of England by witless fools who couldn't abide his wise wit, said that those who will not reason are bigots. Those who cannot are fools. And those who dare not are slaves. How true these words are today, when bigots, fools, and slaves are in the ascendant, and the wise are not where they should be. You can read more about fools and foolishness elsewhere on our website. Meanwhile, when a fool in his foolishness is happy, it is cruel to make him wise before the appointed time. This is why we don't answer every question readers put to us. Better a happy fool than a miserable sage. There you go. I love this site. Okay. Now, there was something else I was looking at that I might start to get into. Because my computer is just bulging. It's a groaning board of articles. I just keep bookmarking them one after another, and they're all good, and they're all talking about what's going on. Oh, my God. And then I say, no, no, we have enough here on the station to get into this. I'm going to go elsewhere. With my little 2 hours a week, I'm going to go elsewhere, and I will let the others do as they feel fit about this. Which is, I think, fair. Now, here it is. I had done this once before, several years ago. This is just superbly excellent. And it's another article, three part, it's big, occult-mysteries.org. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And this one is entitled, The Road Goes Ever On. Part one, as my little first article was a little suggesting. A three-part investigation of the esotericism in J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, the author's mythos, legendarium, and involvement with occultism. Introduction. To attempt to plunge straight into complex explanations of the esotericism in The Lord of the Rings would be both foolhardy and counterproductive. Were we to do so, you would most probably give up after reading a few lines and find something less challenging to occupy your time, and it serves us right. So we will begin at the beginning with Tolkien's mythos and then proceed to his legendarium, the collection of legends and histories he invented, out of which the book evolved, before getting to the heart of the matter. For it is important to bear in mind that The Lord of the Rings did not spring out of nowhere. Its origins go right back to Tolkien's early childhood and his fascination with languages, mythology, legends, history, and storytelling. By following this many-stranded trail from its inception and carefully examining its growth and development, we aim to make this three-part investigation interesting, enjoyable, and instructive, and so avoid the mistakes of other writers who have either said too little or too much about the man and his books. In this way, we may all learn something to our advantage. In the first of our afterwards, we will consider Tolkien's mythos, which runs right through The Lord of the Rings and is the foundation of it, whilst our article will examine the hidden meaning in some of the poems to be found in the book. In the second and third articles, we explore these themes in greater detail, as well as Tolkien's legendarium and involvement with the occult. Our main aim, however, is to encourage readers unfamiliar with the book or who have been put off it by the intellectual literati who disparage Tolkien's work to read it with a seeing eye, for there is much concealed wisdom to be found within it, as we shall see as we develop our theme. It is not our intention to write a biography of the author. There are plenty of these to be had, most notably that written by Humphrey Carpenter, published in 1977 by George Allen and Unwin. Nor do we wish to write a synopsis of the book, characters, and plot, as this can easily be found online and in print. Neither will we refer to the films made by Peter Jackson, except in passing. For although they remain immensely more popular than the book, the many changes he made render them inaccurate and misleading. Whilst we would not go so far as to dismiss the films entirely, we have much sympathy with the comment made about them by Christopher Tolkien, the author's son and literary executor, who said, "The chasm between the beauty and seriousness of the work and what it has become has overwhelmed me. The commercialization has reduced the aesthetic and philosophical impact of the creation to nothing. They eviscerated the book by making it an action movie for young people aged 15 to 25. Our investigation is based on the text of the second edition of The Lord of the Rings, published by George Allen and Unwin in 1966. Later impressions and editions, most notably the 50th anniversary edition, published in 2004 by HarperCollins, which included more than 200 emendations, do not differ materially from the 1966 edition. Readers interested in purchasing the book will find no difficulty in obtaining it either new or secondhand in various formats from prices as low as £1. This is an English site, by the way. So there really is no excuse not to possess your own printed copy of this timeless mythic masterpiece. The greatest book of the century. Written mainly between 1937 and 1949, The Lord of the Rings was first published in three parts between July 1954 and October 1955 by George Allen and Unwin in the UK, Erroneously called a trilogy by some, these parts, The Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, and The Return of the King, form one continuous narrative. The book did not become widely popular until it was discovered by American college students in the mid-60s, which is kind of when I found it, early 70s. Despite this inauspicious beginning, it has been called the greatest work of fiction of the 20th century, and by 2010, the book had sold over 150 million copies worldwide. Its principal themes, good and evil, reverence for nature, scientific materialism versus spirituality, self-sacrifice and transformation through suffering, and the redeeming power of love are as relevant today as when the book was written nearly 80 years ago. When, in 1997, The Lord of the Rings was voted the greatest book of the century in a nationwide poll in the UK, the literary critics were unanimous in their dismay and opprobrium. Oh, hell, has it? Oh, my God, dear, oh, dear, sobbed one shocked member of the British literati. Worse was to follow. The writer, Howard Jacobson, reacted with splenetic scorn. Tolkien, author of the century. That's for children, isn't it? It just shows the folly of teaching people to read. It's another black day for British culture. The Times literary supplement described the results of the polls as horrifying. While the Guardian newspaper complained that The Lord of the Rings must be, by any reckoning, one of the worst books ever written. A previous generation of literary pundits were similarly dismissive of the book on its publication in 1954. What is it about the book that caused it to be such a sensation? Why does it inspire such opprobrium and derision on the one hand and abiding love, praise, and wonderment on the other? Why does it resonate with the hearts of millions of readers and antagonize the heads of its critics? The answer lies in the previous quotations. Howard Jacobson was nearer the truth than he realized when he said that the book was fit only for children. Just as other critics who lambasted it as fit only for adolescent boys were equally right, but not for the reasons they imagined. The fact of the matter is that children, if all the innocence and purity with which they came into incarnation has not been educated out of them, intuitively recognize truth and beauty when they encounter it. Our own century is no less mean-spirited, cynical, and materialistic than the last. Yet for those who retain the wonder and simplicity of a little child, fresh from its heavenly home, the Lord of the Rings still has the power to inspire and instruct the mind and gladden the heart. Whatever you have read the book, whether you have read the book or not, we venture to hope that what we shall put before you will do just that. Unless ye become as little children, ye shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. The fact that Tolkien was a great letter writer throughout his long life and that many of his letters have been published, see further reading list in the sidebar, makes our task very much easier, and we shall quote his own words extensively as we develop our theme. But before we do so, we would like to touch on two contentious points, which, on the face of it, seem to contradict the premise that there is any esotericism at all in The Lord of the Rings. The first sticking point is the author's statement that the book is a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, whereas most readers and critics alike regard it as fantasy fiction. The second are his oft-quoted remarks that the book is not to be understood allegorically. Neither of these statements is entirely true, and both are misleading. Let us deal with the former first. A religious and Catholic work. Anyone who imagines that there is no esotericism in the Catholic Church either knows very little about Christianity or has never attended a Catholic Mass when it is conducted by a priest with real spiritual power. Those who have will not be in any doubt that it is a magical rite in every sense of the word. There are present all the ingredients employed by magicians throughout the ages in all parts of the world. We have an altar, incense, holy water, sacred vestments, candles, invocations in the form of prayers and music, and a host of other aids and appurtenances, all designed to raise up the minds of the congregation in the celebration of the mysteries of God. We find that many of these same ingredients, in The Lord of the Rings. Music plays a central part in the lives and actions of the elves. The wizard Gandalf employs magic in several places in the book, whilst the One Ring itself is a magical talisman of great occult power. Nor is religion absent from the book. The dictionary tells us that religion is a set of beliefs concerning the cause, nature, and purpose of the universe, especially when considered as the creation of a superhuman agency or agencies, usually involving devotional or ritual observances and often containing a moral code governing the conduct of human affairs. Although superhuman agencies are only hinted at in the narrative and there are precious few ritual observances in the book, Tolkien's elves are immortal beings who follow a moral code that informs and guides all their actions. The wizard Gandalf, too, as we shall see in part two of our investigation, is an agent of the Valar, or the gods, who rule Middle-earth under the sovereignty of Eru Ilúvatar, the supreme being in Tolkien's mythos. There are few better definitions of what religion really is than that given by Hermes Trismegistus thousands of years ago, which we quote on our Occult Maxims page. And here it is, right here. Religion is a lofty philosophy. Without philosophy, there is no lofty religion. He who instructs himself concerning the universe, its laws and its principles, its beginning and its end, gives thanks for all things to the Creator as a gracious father, a good protector, a faithful teacher. This is religion, and by means of it, we know where truth is and what it is. Thus, Hermes Trismegistus. Back to the article. I won't get far here. Actually, I'm going to stop. The music's going to come in. This is Pat Rabbit with Not For Public Consumption. And you're listening at Revolution Radio, found at freedomslips.com, or found at revolution.radio. Couldn't be much harder than that. And that's not hard at all. We have two studios. We're entirely user-supported, and we need your help to keep going. Please bear that in mind and give as generously as you can. We are getting into our 10th year now, finishing up our 9th, I believe is how it is. And we've always managed to make it, but nonetheless, I would be remiss not to sit here and beg you for money. It's what we always do. We always get by, but it's almost like the skin of our teeth. Or we just do it that way because we like the drama, right? Yeah, okay. Whatever. Whatever floats our boat, but we need money to keep going. And when it's easy to give. You hit the donate button, use your debit card, your credit card, or you can send checks and money orders to Lady Horse, or you can become a patron at Patreon and give so much a month. And not to let things go too soon, but I believe the archives will be bound up in that. And right now, the archives are free through September. So go for them too, please. Coming up after me, right after me, after my next hour on A, will be Willow Andreasen with Willow's World. And after me on B will be Mona Radler with The Adventures of a Feral Hippie. And Mario will be at 6 on B, and after him will be Mr. Rowe, and I always forget who's going to be at 6 on A, but a quick scroll down will reveal the schedule. And I heartily entreat you to pester yourself with that. Just wear it out. Learn all the shows, where they are. Be surprised. We have new shows coming in all the time. I'll be right back.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Did you ever feel that things were not quite right? That everything was just ever so slightly askew?
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Mackie.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution. Radio!
Oh, please, oh, the moon did die. Hi, Karl Marx here. I am all seriousness today, my friends. There is this show you must not listen to. The ultimate remedy with this guy, LB. This guy has figured me out. I hear it on Tuesday, and he is telling the truth. I mean lies. Stay away from this guy. Where's my good hairbrush? Anybody see my mama?
Want to learn more about the Marxist agenda and other important stuff? Listen to The Ultimate Remedy with L.B. Bork, Tuesdays, 6 p.m. Eastern, right here on Revolution Radio.
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Here I am. It's Pat Rabbit with Not For Public Consumption. Thank you for listening. I'm reading an article at occult-mysteries.org, and I heartily recommend you go to the site and check it out. It's my favorite site. I mean, there are many sites I like, but this one is just outstanding. Let's see. I'm typing, so bear with me for a second. There you go. There it is. Now, of course, what you see happen on the chat and what you hear me saying are about 30 seconds removed from each other. So it is. That's just the way it is. Okay. Now, let me get back to the article and where I was. I just finished reading something that Hermes Trismegistus said. Thrice majestic, Trismegistus. And the article picks up. We are in no doubt that notwithstanding his staunch, if at times unorthodox, Catholicism, Tolkien would have been in full agreement with these wise and true words, regardless of the fact that they were uttered by a so-called pagan. All this affirms Tolkien's contention that The Lord of the Rings is a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. For we should not forget that Catholic does not only mean the church of that name, but as the dictionary tells us, broad-minded, wide-ranging, involving all things, from the Greek Catholicos, meaning universal. Those who have come to know Tolkien well through his books and letters will agree with us that he was nobody's fool and often had his tongue firmly in his cheek when dealing with overenthusiastic fans and carping critics alike. Consequently, he would have been well aware of the double meaning in the word Catholic and may have chosen it deliberately to satisfy the apostles of religious orthodoxy whilst still remaining true to his own private ideas, which, as we shall see later, did not always coincide with the dogmas of the Catholic Church, of which he was a lifelong member. A lot of us were born Catholic. I was. I don't know, and I'm not even a Christian, but I had to come to that conclusion myself, you understand? No. Yeah, you do understand, I know. Okay, allegorical misconceptions. It is generally thought by readers and scholars alike that Tolkien was famously hostile to allegory. This is at best a misconception and at worst completely false. Although Tolkien expressed his cordial dislike of allegory more than once, what he really meant by this and what he personally understood by allegory is another matter. In his foreword to the second edition of The Lord of the Rings, published in 1966, Tolkien wrote, "As for any inner meaning or a message, it has... in the intention of the author, none." That's an interesting way to say it. As for any inner meaning or message, it has in the intention of the author, none. It is neither allegorical nor topical. Later on in the same letter, he adds, "But I cordially dislike allegory in all its manifestations and always have done so since I grew old and weary enough to detect its presence. I much prefer history, true or feigned, with its varied applicability to the thought and experience of readers. I think that many confuse applicability with allegory, but the one resides in the freedom of the reader and the other in the purposed domination of the author." Oops. A little higher than I meant to. In another letter sent to the publisher in late 1951, Tolkien wrote, "I dislike allegory, the conscious and intentional allegory, yet any attempt to explain the purport of myth or fairy tale must use allegorical language. And, of course, the more life the story has, the more readily it will be susceptible of allegorical interpretations. While the better a deliberate allegory is made, the more nearly it will be acceptable just as a story." End quote. At first glance, this seems to contradict what Tolkien wrote several years later in his foreword quoted above, writing to a bookseller just after the book was published in 1954, Tolkien had this to say about the enigmatical character of Tom Bombadil, who appears in the first part of the book, The Fellowship of the Ring. Quote, "I don't think Tom needs philosophizing about and is not improved by it. I do not mean him to be an allegory, or I should not have given him so particular individual and ridiculous a name, but allegory is the only mode of exhibiting certain functions. He is then an allegory or an exemplar, a particular embodying of pure, real, natural science." End quote. We shall have more to say about the enigmatical Tom Bombadil in the final part of our investigation. Still later in 1955, Tolkien wrote to the poet W.H. Auden, who had just given a talk about The Lord of the Rings for the BBC. In a larger sense, it is, I suppose, impossible to write any story that is not allegorical in proportion as it comes to life, since each of us is an allegory, embodying in a particular tale and clothed in the garments of time and place, universal truth, and everlasting life. End quote. What are we to make of these seemingly contradictory statements? What is clear is that Tolkien wavered in his definition of and views on allegory. Why he did so, no one has ever bothered to discover, though the simple reason is not far to seek. Later in the foreword, Tolkien writes, "The real Second World War does not resemble," he's talking about the Second World War because of the time, he just called it the real war, "does not resemble the legendary war of the ring in the book in its process or its conclusion. If it had inspired or directed the development of the legend, then certainly the ring would have been seized and used against Sauron. He would not have been annihilated, but enslaved, and Barad-dûr would not have been destroyed, but occupied." Oh, how true that is, huh? "Saruman, failing to get possession of the ring, would, in the confusion and treacheries of the time, have found in Mordor the missing links in his own researches into ring lore, and before long, he would have made a great ring of his own with which to challenge the self-styled ruler of Middle-earth. In that conflict, both sides would have held hobbits in hatred and contempt. They would not long have survived, even as slaves." So said Tolkien. The fact that so many of his readers and critics insisted on assuming that the book mirrored the events of the Second World War is sufficient reason for Tolkien's contradictory statements about allegory. The dictionary tells us that an allegory is a representation of an abstract or spiritual meaning through concrete or material forms, a symbolical narrative. The emphasis is ours. From this, it is clear that what irked Tolkien was the assumption that he had deliberately and consciously constructed an allegory of topical events. Had the book not been written during the Second World War, it is doubtful whether the author would ever have mentioned allegory at all, or felt the need to deny its presence in his book. We see the same misconceptions in regard to the allegories in the Bible, many of which are interpreted as referring to specific historical events and persons when there is nothing in them to support such supposititious speculations. And as an aside, oh boy, doesn't that happen all the time? All this prophecy, end times, see what the Bible says about this, and blah, blah, blah. Okay. In short, Tolkien's ambiguous remarks about allegory arose from his justifiable concern that he didn't want his story to be seen as allegory for topical events and persons. He wanted his inner message to be universal and timeless. And so it is for those who are able to read between the lines of his narrative, as we shall see later. We are surprised that, to the best of our knowledge, the simple explanation for the clear presence of the many allegorical elements in The Lord of the Rings, which the author apparently denied has not yet occurred to the readers or critics who have hotly debated this point over the years and still argue about it today. As our regular readers will know from our many articles on symbolism, allegory does not consist, as many imagine, in deliberately foisting only one possible interpretation upon the reader. On the contrary, the whole point and aim of allegorical compositions is to enshrine a whole body of meaning in a phrase, a symbol, myth, or legend for the reader to freely discover in the light of his or her higher reason. Moreover, if an allegory be worthy of the name, whether it is a biblical parable, a fairy story, or a vast mythic tale like The Lord of the Rings, it must tell a complete story in its own right, which both engages the mind and moves the heart, regardless of any hidden meaning. If it did not, it would quickly sink into oblivion and be forgotten. This is not a fate that is ever likely to befall The Lord of the Rings, as we saw in our introduction. If we wish for confirmation of Tolkien's use of allegory, we need look no further than a short story he wrote in 1939 whilst he was at work on The Lord of the Rings. The story was called Leif by Nigel and first appeared in the Dublin Review in 1945. Later, it was republished several times in various collections of Tolkien's writings. The story concerns an artist, Nigel by name, who paints a canvas of a great tree in a society that does not value art for its own sake, but only as a tool of commerce. Doesn't that start to sound familiar? He spends so much time and effort painting every leaf of his tree with such niggling attention to detail that he ends up discarding all his other artworks or tacks them onto the main canvas, which become a single vast embodiment of his vision, yet remains unfinished at his death. If this is not an allegory of Tolkien's own life and work, we do not know what is. If we regard the Lord of the Rings as a tree, then the mythology and philosophy of the Silmarillion may be considered to be the roots which underpinned and nourished it, whilst the branches and leaves are his short stories, essays, and poems, many parts of which he grafted onto the Lord of the Rings in one form or another. Like Nigel, Tolkien faced many chores and duties that kept him from the work he loved, and like Nigel, he was an inveterate procrastinator, taking up and abandoning projects, endlessly rewriting the pages he drafted. Even when his work was to be republished, he continued niggling at it until the last possible moment. This is not true of Leif by Nigel. The story appeared to him in a dream, and he wrote it down in one sitting, barely correcting it before it was published. It was, as he himself said, as if it had always been there in my mind, and had only to come out. This immediacy is a perfect example of the workings of true inspiration when not impeded or distorted by the intellect. Gotta watch out for that intellect. It can be a real stumbling block. To continue, that was me. I do claim guilt for editorializing now and again. To continue, the tale takes on a surreal turn when Nigel catches a train after being incarcerated in a psychiatric institute against his will. When he asks the porter where the train is going, the answer he receives is, "I don't think they have fixed its name yet, but you'll find it all right." Although Tolkien does not spell out what has happened, the allegory is clear. A great shadow came between him and the sun. In other words, Nigel has died, and he finds himself in a landscape which seems both strange and oddly familiar. Next, he sees his tree. Before him stood the tree, his tree, finished. If you could say that of a tree that was alive, its leaves opening, its branches growing and bending in the wind, that Nigel had so often felt or guessed, and had so often failed to catch. He gazed at the tree, and slowly He lifted his arms and opened them wide. "It's a gift," he said. He was referring to his art and also to the result, but he was using the word quite literally. He went on looking at the tree. All the leaves he had ever labored at were there, as he had imagined them, rather than as he had made them. And there were others that had only budded in his mind, and many that might have budded if only he had had time. Nothing was written on them. They were just exquisite leaves, yet they were dated as clear as a calendar. Some of the most beautiful and some of the most characteristic, the most perfect examples of the niggle style were to be seen, were to have been produced in collaboration with Mr. Parrish. There was no other way of putting it. End quote. Mr. Parrish is Niggle's neighbor in the story, and he plays a prominent part in the tale. We may take this as a further allegory, for the creation of great works of art is a collaborative exercise in which the creator, consciously or more often unconsciously, receives his inspiration from the higher realms of light and from the minds of those attuned to that light, as we may read in Vision 6 of The Golden Star. Great book. In that chapter, the divine messenger, Neturu-Hem, describes the ocean of spiritual fire in the higher realms whence inspiration flows into the minds of men. Quote, "An ocean of inspiration, this. And if but one such tiny spark you see descends into a poet's mind, lo, an immortal work will be created. His pen drips honey and ambrosia, and with a careless gesture he scatters jeweled thoughts like stars upon the universe of other minds." End quote. Nor is the artist, poet, or musician always conscious of the full impact of what he paints, writes, or composes in his moment of mental exaltation. For if he were, he might be tempted to impose his own interpretation upon what he has seen or heard, and so distort the purity of the original conception. This is certainly true of Tolkien, who had a gift for far-seeing vision, which enabled him to penetrate deeply into nature and her hidden laws, putting them into words which might have been written by a great initiate. Unless we accept that memory does not reside in the brain, but in the higher self, and that the inspired writer is able to contact these memories, as well as the oceans of inspiration referred to above, Tolkien's profound esoteric knowledge remains inexplicable. In connection with this, one mysterious visitor to the author's home is said to have asked him, "You don't really think you wrote all those stories, do you?" Tolkien's reply is not recorded, but we may conjecture that the question gave him much food for thought. We have now seen that Tolkien employ allegory, whether consciously or not, but thoroughly approved of it, though he was at pains to discourage the superficial political and topical interpretation of it, and no one can blame him for that. Poetry in The Lord of the Rings. Let me check something. Okay. Hello, mechanic. Okay. Poetry in The Lord of the Rings. Most readers regard Tolkien as a writer, not a poet. This is a mistake, for it is in many, but not all, of the poems which appear in The Lord of the Rings that we may discover some of the greatest occult truths and many of the hidden laws of nature. The most well-known of these poems, "The Road Goes Ever On," forms the title of this investigation and appears in various versions in the book as well as in The Hobbit. The first time we encounter it is in Book 1, Chapter 1 of The Fellowship of the Ring, where it is recited by Bilbo Baggins, the hero of The Hobbit, as he is about to leave the Shire for the last time. and it goes. The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow if I can. Pursuing it with eager feet until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then I cannot say. This is the first version of the poem, or the second, if we include the version first included in The Hobbit, which appears in The Lord of the Rings, and each is filled with hidden meaning, as we shall see. The second time we encounter the poem is in Chapter 3 of Book 1. It is identical, except for the change from the personal pronoun to the third person in the fourth line, and the substitution of the word weary for eager in the fifth line. These changes are significant and probably deliberate, for once we know we are on the right path, it is natural we should wish others to follow it too. Furthermore, the path to the light has its difficulties, as many of our regular readers will know. However eagerly we pursue it, there are times when our feet grow weary. The final appearance of the poem is in The Return of the King, Book 6, Chapter 6, where it is recited by Bilbo in Rivendell. And here it is. The road goes ever on and on, out from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone. Let others follow it who can. Let them a journey new begin, but I at last, with weary feet, will turn towards the lighted inn, my evening rest and sleep to meet. Earlier, when leaving the Shire, Frodo tells the other hobbits Bilbo's thoughts on the road, saying, "He used often to say there was only one road, that it was like a great river. Its springs were at every doorstep, and every path was its tributary. It's a dangerous business, Frodo, going out of your door," he used to say. "You step onto the road, and if you don't keep your feet, there is no knowing where you might be swept off to." To understand the allegories concealed in these several versions and discover their occult meaning, we need to study the poem given in The Hobbit first. We quote it in full, for it contains much of interest to us. Okay, here it is in The Hobbit. There's two stanzas. "Roads go ever on, over rock and under tree, by caves where never sun has shone, by streams that never find the sea. Over snow by winter sown, and through the merry flowers of June, over grass and over stone, and under mountains in the moon. Roads go ever on, under cloud and under star, yet feet that wandering have gone turn at last to home afar. Eyes that fire and sword have seen, and horror in the halls of stone, look at last on meadows green, and trees and hills they long have known." And the article picks up. What do you make of it, dear reader? Let us consider the first line, "Roads go ever on." No earthly road does, for they all have a terminus, so we may discard at once any literal interpretation, for that will lead us nowhere, and we do hope to get somewhere, do we not? The only roads that never end are the roads which evolution travels. For, as you can read in our study course article on this subject, there never can be an end to evolution. Or, if there is, it is so far removed in time and space from our limited understanding that to all intents and purposes, it is never-ending and eternal. Note the references to rock and tree. The evolution of the mineral and vegetable kingdoms. Caves where never sun has shone may refer to the lower realms, the night side of evolution, as well as to the cave of the human body and lower self, which is dark indeed if not illuminated by the light of the higher self. But what of the streams that never find the sea? Surely all streams must do so eventually? Here again, we see that a literal meaning, reading of these verses tells us nothing and makes little sense. But there are mental streams, currents of thought and desire, which never reach the sea of wisdom, because they lose themselves in intellectual speculations and purely material aspirations. The next lines affirm that evolution proceeds in seasons and cycles, reminding us of the well-known verses from Ecclesiastes chapter 3. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. The references to grass and stone suggest that sometimes the way is easy and at others fraught with difficulties and obstacles, confirming that the poem describes a moral and spiritual journey, not an earthly ramble. The last line, under the mountains of the moon, is the most esoteric of all, for it refers in a concealed manner to the mystery of man's origin, hinted at in the secret doctrine, in which we may read, quote, the human being came out from the moon, a triple mystery, astronomical, physiological, and psychical all at once. He crossed the whole cycle of existence and then returned to his birthplace before issuing from it again, end quote, for the secret doctrine. The second line of the second verse, under cloud and under star, may refer to those incarnations when we wandered off the path into the mists of non-comprehension, later to turn at last to home afar, following the star that points the way back to the divine source from which we first emerged at the commencement of our long pilgrimage of many lives. But no one turns their feet to home until they have learned the bitter lessons of material existence. Only when they have experienced fire and sword and all the horrors and sorrows mortal man is heir to, will they be ready to look at last on meadows green and dwell once more among their kin in heavenly bliss among the trees and hills they long have known. That, at any rate, is how we read the hidden messages in this remarkable poem. This begs the question whether Tolkien was consciously aware of the hidden meaning in his poems. Knowing somewhat of the mysterious process of inspiration, we should say that he was not. We alluded to this earlier when we discussed the contentious subject of allegory. We may therefore say that the gifted poet who is under the afflatus of divine inspiration may not always be consciously aware of the import of all they put down on paper any more than Tolkien was. Let us see what other good things we can discover in the versions of the poem that appear to us later on in The Lord of the Rings. The second version, found in chapter 3, Three is Company, is sung by the hobbits when they are walking through the Shire, just before they meet a company of elves. Three stanzas are given in the text, which the first stanza, starting, upon the hearth the fire is red. The following extract is from the second stanzas of the poem. Still round the corner there may wait a new road or a secret gate. And though we pass them by today, tomorrow, we may come this way and take the hidden paths that run towards the moon or to the sun. It is this part of the poem that is reprised with different words later in the book. This third version is sung softly by Frodo as he and Sam walk in the Shire a few years after they have returned. And as Frodo prepares to meet Elrond and others and journey to the gray havens to take the ship into the west. Still round the corner, there may wait a new road or a secret gate. And though I oft have passed them by, a day will come at last when I shall take the hidden paths that run west of the moon and east of the sun. The earliest version of this stanza we have been able to find is given in Christopher Tolkien's The Complete History of Middle-earth, Volume 2, and it goes, "Home is behind, the world ahead, and there are many paths to tread, and round the corner there may wait a new road or a secret gate, and hidden pathways there may run towards the moon or to the sun." These enigmatical lines make concealed reference to the occult mysteries of the sun and moon, as well as the secrets of reincarnation and evolution, as H.P. Blavatsky alludes to these mysteries in her customary cautious manner in The Secret Doctrine, when she describes the Hindu concept of lunar and solar dynasties, the former being the Chandravansas, who follow the path to the moon, and the Suryavansas, who follow the path to the sun. These paths have a deep physiological, psychical, and spiritual significance, which will not be lost on some of our readers. In the published book, the last stanza of the poem is rendered as follows. Note that the first line, "Home is behind, the world ahead," is followed in the fifth line by, "Then world behind and home ahead." This is significant, as we shall see. Here it goes. "Home is behind, the world ahead, and there are many paths to tread through shadows to the edge of night until the stars are all alight. Then world behind and home ahead, we'll wander back and home to bed. Mist and twilight, cloud and shade, away shall fade, away shall fade." When we commence our long journey of many incarnations, home is behind and the material world ahead. We may consider the many paths to be the various choices we make and the directions we take during our lives on earth, some leading to the edge of night toward error and darkness, until, having learned our lessons of material existence, our stars are all alight. We have transmuted the base matter of our material selves into pure spiritual gold and shine with the luster of our hard-won wisdom. Then begins the journey home in full consciousness. For us, there will be no more dwelling in mist and twilight, for we shall behold the light in all its radiant sublimity. The cloud which obscured our vision is no more, neither does the shade, the night side of light, life, and those who belong to it, hold any fears or attractions for us. All these illusions now fade away in the realization of our heritage. We are free at last and stand upon the mountaintop, liberated, purified, and filled with the joy of our homecoming. Here we must end our brief survey of the poems in The Lord of the Rings. There are many more we have not had time to consider, and we must warn you that not all of them have a hidden meaning, such as the following. And it goes, "Sing hey for the bath at close of day that washes the weary mud away. A loon is he that will not sing. Oh, water hot is a noble thing." And also, "There is an inn, a merry old inn beneath an old gray hill. And there they brew a beer so brown that the man in the moon himself came down one night to drink his fill." These are simple, homely rhymes that make us smile, reminding us that life is not all about dry and dusty study, but should be fun, too, though we hope that you will not find this study either dry or dusty. On the contrary, we hope that it will refresh your mind and heart as much as it has given us pleasure to research and write it. Before we bid Tolkien's wonderful verses farewell, we cannot resist sharing one final poem with you. Here it is. See what you can make of it without our help, for that is the way. That is the only way to learn to read between the lines of symbolical compositions, as we discussed in the afterword to our allegorical tale of The Broken Violin, and in more depth in our afterword to our article on occult symbolism in The Magic Flute, which is by Mozart, you may be aware. If you have not read these articles, now is a good time to do so. And it goes, all that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king. And that's that article. And seeing the time, I could even start the second one because there's some amazing stuff in it. I'll leave the afterwards behind and get to some of the other things they write about with Tolkien. They say, in the first of these three articles, we explored the esoteric themes of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, the mythos that underlies it, and the hidden meaning in some of the poems to be found in the book. In the second part, we explore these themes in greater detail with special reference to good and evil, the fall of man, and the rings of power, subjects which form the heart and soul of the author's narrative. In our afterward, we summarize Tolkien's legendarium, the collection of legends and histories he invented, out of which the Lord of the Rings evolved, and which formed the background to the story. In part three, we examine the metaphysical themes in the book further and the symbolism of some of the characters. Our final afterward focuses on Tolkien's involvement with the occult through his association with Charles Williams and Owen Barfield, who subtly influenced the formation of his complex mythos. If you have not read part one, we suggest you do so before reading further, or you will not reap the full benefits of this investigation. Good and evil. Some critics regard Tolkien's conceptions of good and evil as it is played out in the book as naive and simple-minded, dismissing the good protagonists as all good and the evil as all bad. This is untrue. There are many characters in the book in whom vice and virtue is inextricably mixed, such as Boromir, Saruman, and even Gollum, as we shall see in part three, nor are the elves wholly good and always on the side of right, partly because they flirted with Sauron and even assisted him in his evil designs, and partly because in their longing to preserve their way of life indefinitely, they too rebelled against the Valar, or gods. In Tolkien's legendarium, as in the real world, men and gods were capable of many degrees of error, ranging from the satanic rebellion of Melkor and his servant Sauron to the mistakes of some of the other higher angelic powers. Nor were the wizards exempt from this dichotomy either. Being spiritual beings incarnated in material bodies, they too were liable to stray and err. Gandalf alone, and to a lesser extent, Galadriel and Frodo may be said to be wholly good, though all three make mistakes too. Tolkien himself wrote, some critics seem determined to represent me as a simple-minded adolescent and insist on willfully distorting what is said in my tale. I have not that spirit, and it does not appear in the story. The figure of Denethor, alone is enough to show this, but I have not made any of the peoples on the right side, hobbits, Rohirrim, men of the Dale, or of Gondor, any better than men have been or are or can be. Mine is not an imaginary world, but an imaginary historical moment on Middle Earth. It's very real to me. And that's my little editorial back to the article. This is important, for although Middle Earth is an invention, the events that occur in it and the laws which govern it are no less real than anything in our own world. Or we might say that Middle Earth is a metaphor for the world we know, which recapitulates much of the history of the Earth and its peoples, of which much less is known than our historians are willing to admit. For all we know, hobbit-like creatures did once exist on Earth. Dwarves and elves certainly did and do, for they are none other than the inhabitants of the invisible kingdoms of the occult elements of fire, air, water, and earth. But let us see what else Tolkien said about evil. In my story, I do not deal in absolute evil. I do not think there is such a thing, since that is zero. I do not think that, at any rate, any rational being is wholly evil. Satan fell. In my myth, Morgoth, Melkor, fell before the creation of the physical world. In my story, Sauron represents as near an approach to the wholly evil will as is possible. He has gone the way of all tyrants, beginning well, at least on the level that while desiring to order all things according to his wisdom, he still at first considered the well-being of other inhabitants of the earth. But he went further than the human tyrants in pride and the lust for domination, being in origin an immortal angelic spirit. In Tolkien's legendarium, evil is not eternal. Nothing is evil in the beginning. Even Sauron was not so, says Elrond in Book 2 of The Fellowship of the Ring. Evil arises as a result of a series of falls in Tolkien's mythos. The Lucifer-like fall of Melkor, the fall of the elves, and the fall of men. As Tolkien explains in one of his letters, Sauron desired to be a god-king and was held to be this by his servants. If he had been victorious, he would have demanded divine honor from all rational creatures and absolute temporal power over the whole world. In The Lord of the Rings, the primary means of overcoming evil is love. This love manifests itself in many ways in the story, the most important of which are the trust and self-sacrifice involved in friendship and through acts of kindness, mercy, and pity. The friendship between Sam and Frodo is at the heart of the story, but the friendship that develops between all of the nine companions in the fellowship formed to fulfill the quest of destroying the One Ring is equally important. Gandalf sacrifices himself for friendship in Moria. Boromir is killed in an effort to save the hobbits, Merry and Pippin. Aragorn and his army intend to sacrifice themselves at the Black Gate of Mordor to help Sam and Frodo achieve their goal. Ultimately, Frodo sacrifices himself for the Fellowship and for all of Middle-earth. As he explains to Sam, I tried to save the Shire, and it has been saved, but not for me. It must often be so, Sam. When things are in danger, someone has to give them up. Lose them so that others may keep them. This faithfully echoes the words of Jesus in the Gospels. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. John 15:13. And the love and pity shown by Bilbo in sparing Gollum's life ultimately determines the entire fate of Middle-earth, for it is Gollum who destroys the One Ring at the end of the book. Perhaps the most palpable embodiment of evil in The Lord of the Rings are the Balrogs, semi-material creatures of shadow, flame, and smoke, which remind us of nothing so much as the demons of folklore, legend, and religious iconography. According to the Silmarillion, Balrogs are lesser spirits Malkor corrupted to his service, who became known as demons of might. Tolkien gives us a vivid description of one of these creatures towards the end of the Fellowship of the Ring when Gandalf confronts a Balrog on the bridge of Khazad Dûm. Quote, something was coming up behind them. What it was could not be seen. It was like a great shadow, in the middle of which was a dark form. A man shape, maybe, yet greater, and a power and terror seemed to be in it and to go before it. The Balrog reached the bridge. Gandalf stood in the middle of the span, leaning on his staff in his left hand, but in his other hand, Glamdring gleamed, gold, cold and white. His enemy halted again, facing him, and the shadow about it reached out like two vast wings. It raised the whip, and the throngs whined and cracked. Fire came from its nostrils, but Gandalf stood firm. You cannot pass, he said. The orcs stood still, and a dead silence fell. I am a servant of the secret fire, wielder of the flame of Arnor. You cannot pass. The dark fire will not avail you, flame of Udun. Go back to the shadow. You cannot pass. What particularly interests us in these enigmatical lines is Tolkien's mention of two fires, the flame of Udun and the secret fire, or the flame of Arnor. Udun is a word in Tolkien's invented Elvish language of Sindarin, meaning dark pit or hell, whilst Arnor was a name for the sun and the seat of the High King of Gondor in Middle-earth, the heir to the Empire of Numenor. All this is replete with hidden meaning, which will not be lost on some of our readers. The superficial interpretation of this passage is that Gandalf has the power of good on his side, whilst the Balrog serves the forces of evil. In identifying himself as a servant of the Valar, Tolkien's gods, he also refers to his divine origin as one of the Maiar. In Tolkien's mythos, the Maiar, singular Maia, were a class of primordial spirits that descended into Arda, which is earth, to help the Valar to form the world. Sauron was one of these spirits, as was Gandalf's adversary, Saruman, more of which in part 3 when we discuss some of the principal characters in the book. But there is much more in these lines than a simple affirmation of the nature of the protagonists in the war between good and evil. Occult science teaches that there is a deep philosophy underlying the mystery of fire. Of all the phenomena known to physical science, fire is the one that continues to elude definite analysis. Science confidently asserts that fire is the effect of combustion, or more prolixiously, the rapid oxidation of a material in the exothermic chemical process of combustion, releasing heat, light, and various reaction products. End quote. These scientific definitions are philosophically supplemented by the theological, which explained fire as the instrument of punishment, or the punishment of the impenitent in another spiritual state. Ooh, Lord. End quote. Quite why this state should be supposed to be spiritual when the presence of fire would seem to be sufficient proof of its material nature, we leave you to answer. Occult science, on the other hand, says that fire is, quote, the most perfect and unadulterated reflection in heaven as on earth of the one flame. It is life and death, the origin and the end of every material and spiritual thing. It is divine substance. And that's from the Secret Doctrine. In this regard, both Tolkien and the fire-worshipping Zoroastrians, as well as the native tribes of America, which proclaim themselves born of fire, show more science in their creeds and truth in their superstitions than all the speculations of modern science put together. They have more science in their creeds and truths in their superstitions. Yep, so true. That's why I think so little of science. Anyway, even the Christian who says God is a living fire and speaks of the Pentecostal tongues of fire and of the burning bush of Moses is as much a fire worshiper as any so-called pagan. Something of the real nature of fire may be demonstrated by anyone who procures an oil lamp and keeps it supplied with oil. From that one flame, they will be able to light all the lamps, candles, and fires of the whole planet without diminishing the original flame one whit. It is this natural phenomenon which anyone may observe for themselves, which is the basis of the occult scientific axiom. Quote, thus were the formless, arupa, and the formed, rupa, worlds made. From one light, seven lights. From each of the seven, seven times seven. I believe that's the Secret Doctrine too. It says Ibid right after it. To continue, if you combine what we just told you with Tolkien's two fires, you will find they provide a clue to the dual origin of man and the supernormal powers employed by white and black magicians, the former being the servant and wielder of the flame of Arnor, and the latter being the slave of the dark flame of Udun. Madame Blavatsky comes closest to unveiling certain aspects of the mystery of these two fires in the Secret Doctrine when she writes, quote, those angels who, in the esoteric legends, possessed the physical creative fire could only clothe the human monads with their own astral selves. They could not give to man that sacred spark which burns and expands into the flower of human reason and self-consciousness, for they had it not to give. This was left to that class of devas who became symbolized in Greece under the name of Prometheus. To those who had naught to do with the physical body, yet everything with the purely spiritual man. And that could also be added Phosphorus and Lucifer. Okay. I've got about three more minutes. I think I'll stop here. I don't know where to pick it up next week. I love these articles. I think they're great. I read them about 3 years ago, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago. And these guys are nothing if not thorough once they start on something. This is Pat Rabbit with Not For Public Consumption. Thank you for listening. This is Revolution Radio, found at revolution.radio and also found at freedomslips.com. Or if you like to say it, freedomslips.com, but we can't let freedom slip. So there, please help us. We need it. We're coming up to the end of the month. Let's see where we're doing here. If it says... we like 2,000. We're up to 1,315. So we could do some more. Please, please, please. It's expensive running this station. Let me tell you, if you saw it broken down, you might be surprised. And all of us who do work behind the scenes, the management and then the host too, no one here gets paid. This is all a labor of love. The entire thing there, nobody gets paid except those who provide the services that we use. The internet service providers. Chatsy. this, that. Coming up after me on A will be Willow Anderson with Willow's World, and after me on B will be Mona Rattler with The Adventures of a Feral Hippie. And coming up at 6 o'clock on B will be Mario, and at 8 o'clock on B will be Mr. Rowe, and we have more too. Please consult the schedule, because I never do remember to, so that's why I never have it fresh in my mind who might be up at what time after me through the hours of the day. Willow is good at that. So perhaps she can enlighten you, or just, you know, get a little burst of energy and scroll down if you're at the site and not just at the chatsy window. Come to the site and get in the chat there. Then if you just scroll down, you will be at the schedules. We have both of them, one after the other. And if you see something blue, click on it, because it will open up another page where you can get all sorts of nice information that will help you learn about the host and their show and what they do with their lives. So, I hear the music. Same time, same place next week. Take care. Be well. God bless. Pat Rabbit signing off. Ooh.